hemorrhaging, and hair loss, followed by a collapse of the immune system, exhaustion of bone marrow, disintegration of internal organs, and finally, death. To the atomic pioneers who first explored radiant matter at the end of the 19th century, the effects of radiation were a bewitching curiosity. Wilhelm Röntgen, who discovered X-rays in 1895, saw the bones of his hand projected on the wall of his laboratory during the course of an experiment and was intrigued. But when he took the world's first X-ray photograph shortly afterward of his wife's left hand, complete with wedding ring, the result horrified her. "I have seen my own death," she said. Röntgen later took precautions to shield himself from his discovery, but others were not so careful. In 1896, Thomas Edison devised the fluoroscope, which projected X-rays onto a screen, allowing him to gaze inside solid objects. Edison's experiments required an assistant to place his hand repeatedly on top of a box where they were exposed to X-rays. When he sustained burns on one hand, the assistant simply switched to using the other. But the burns wouldn't heal. Eventually, surgeons amputated the assistant's left arm and four fingers from his right hand. When cancer spread up his right arm, the doctors took that, too. The disease traveled to his chest, and in October 1904, he died, the first known victim of man-made radiation. Even as the damage caused by external exposure to radiation became apparent, the harmful effects of internal exposure remained little understood. Throughout the early years of the 20th century, pharmacies sold patent medicines containing radium as a health tonic, drunk by people who believed radioactivity gave them energy. In 1903, Marie and Pierre Curie had won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of polonium and radium, an alpha particle emitter roughly a million times more radioactive than uranium, which they extracted from metric tons of viscous, tarry ore in their Paris laboratory. Pierre was killed in a road accident, but Marie continued exploring the properties of radioactive compounds until she died in 1934, probably due to radiation-induced bone marrow failure. More than 80 years later, Curie's laboratory notes remain so radioactive that they are kept in a lead-lined box. Because radium can be mixed with other elements to make them glow in the dark, clockmakers used it to create fluorescent numbers on watch faces and hired young women to perform the delicate task of painting them. In the watch factories of New Jersey, Connecticut, and Illinois, the radium girls were trained to lick the tips of their brushes into a fine point before dipping them into pots of radium paint. When the jaws and skeletons of the first girls began to rot and disintegrate, their employers suggested that they were suffering from syphilis. A successful lawsuit revealed that their managers had understood the risks of working with radium and yet done everything they could to conceal the truth from their employees. It was the first time the public learned the hazards of ingesting radioactive material. The biological effect of radiation on the human body would eventually be measured in REM, Röntgen equivalent man, and determined by a complicated combination of factors. The type of radiation, the duration of total exposure, how much it penetrates the body and where, and how susceptible those parts of the body are to radiation damage. The parts where cells divide rapidly, bone marrow, skin, and the gastrointestinal tract, are more at risk than other organs such as the heart, liver, and brain. Some radionuclides, such as radium and strontium, are more energetic emitters of radiation and therefore more dangerous than others like cesium and potassium. The survivors of the atom bomb attacks on Hiroshima and 3 days later Nagasaki provided the first opportunity to study the effects of acute radiation syndrome on a large number of people. They would eventually become the subject of a project spanning more than 70 years, creating a universal database on the long-term effects of ionizing radiation on human beings. Of those who lived through the initial explosion in Nagasaki, 35,000 died within 24 hours. Those suffering from ARS lost their hair within 1 or 2 weeks and then experienced bloody diarrhea before succumbing to infection and high fever. Another 37,000 died within 3 months. A similar number survived for longer, but after another 3 years developed leukemia. By the end of the 1940s, the disease would be the first cancer linked to radiation. The effect of ionizing radiation on both inanimate objects and living beings was explored extensively in the late 1950s by the U.S. Air Force. As part of a government program to develop atomic-powered planes, Lockheed Aircraft built a water-cooled 10-megawatt nuclear reactor in a shielded underground shaft in the woods of North Georgia. At the touch of a button, the reactor could be raised from its shielding to ground level, exposing everything within a 300-meter radius to a lethal dose of radiation. In June 1959, the radiation effects reactor was brought up to full power and unsheathed for the first time, killing almost everything in the vicinity stone dead. Bugs fell from the air, and small animals and the bacteria living in and upon them were exterminated in a phenomenon the technicians called instant taxidermy. The effect on plants varied. Oak trees turned brown, yet crabgrass remained strangely unaffected. Pine trees appeared to be the hardest hit of all. The changes in objects caught in the reactor's field seemed equally mysterious. Clear Coca-Cola bottles turned brown. Hydraulic fluid coagulated into chewing gum. Transistorized equipment stopped working, and rubber tires became rock hard. As profound and terrible as exposure to ionizing radiation might prove for human beings, it's rarely accompanied by any detectable sensation. A person might be bathed in enough gamma rays to be killed 100 times over without feeling a thing. On August 21, 1945, 2 weeks after the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, Harry K. Daglian Jr., a 24-year-old physicist on the Manhattan Project, was conducting an after-hours experiment in Los Alamos, New Mexico, when his hand slipped. The test assembly he had built, a ball of plutonium surrounded by tungsten carbide bricks, went critical. Daglian saw a momentary blue flash and was struck by a wave of gamma and neutron radiation amounting to more than 500 rem. He quickly disassembled the experiment, walked away, and admitted himself to medical care without visible symptoms, but radiation had killed him as surely as if he'd stepped in front of an oncoming train. 25 days later, Daglian slipped into a coma from which he never awoke. The first person in history to die accidentally from close exposure to nuclear fission. The New York Times attributed his death to burns sustained in an industrial accident. From the very beginning, the nuclear power industry has struggled to escape the shadow of its military origins. The first nuclear reactor ever built, assembled by hand beneath the bleachers of the University of Chicago's disused football field in 1942, was the anvil of the Manhattan Project. The first essential step in creating the fissile material needed to forge the world's first atomic weapon. The reactors that followed, built on a remote tract of land along the Columbia River in Hanford, Washington, were constructed solely to manufacture plutonium for use in the United States' growing arsenal of atomic bombs. The U.S. Navy was responsible for choosing the reactor design subsequently used in almost every civilian power station in the country. The first nuclear plant constructed for civilian use in the United States was based on blueprints recycled from a planned atomic-powered aircraft carrier. In the USSR, the pattern was the same. The first Soviet atomic bomb, RDS-1, or the Article as it was called by the men who built it, was detonated soon after dawn on August 29, 1949, on a test range 140 kilometers northwest of Semipalatinsk on the steppes of Kazakhstan. The project, codenamed Problem No. 1, was led by Igor Kurchatov, a 46-year-old physicist with the whiskery, forked beard of a Victorian spiritualist, noted by his secret police minders for his discretion and political cunning. The bomb was a faithful copy of the Fat Man device, which had destroyed Nagasaki almost exactly 4 years earlier, and contained a core of plutonium produced in a reactor, known as Reactor A, or Anyushka, initially modeled on the ones in Hanford. Kurchatov had succeeded with the help of a handful of well-placed spies and information contained in the best-selling book, Atomic Energy for Military Purposes, generously published by the U.S. government in 1945 and speedily translated into Russian in Moscow. Nuclear work was the responsibility of the newly formed First Main Directorate and an Atomic Politburo overseen by Stalin's sadistic henchman Lavrenty Beria, head of the NKVD, forerunner of the KGB. From the start, the Soviet nuclear project was governed by principles of ruthless expedience and paranoid secrecy. By 1950, the First Main Directorate would employ 700,000 people, more than half of whom were forced laborers, including at one point 50,000 prisoners of war, working in uranium mines. Yet even when their prison sentences were complete, the directorate packed these men and women into freight cars and shipped them into exile in the Soviet far north to prevent them from telling anyone what they had witnessed. Many were never seen again. And when Kurchatov's team succeeded, Beria rewarded them in direct proportion to the punishment he had planned for them in the event of failure. those that the secret police chief would have ordered immediately shot, Kurchatov himself and Nikolai Dolezal, who designed the Anushka reactor, were instead awarded the state's highest honor, the title Hero of Socialist Labor, along with dachas, cars, and cash prizes. Those who would merely have received maximum prison terms were instead granted the country's next highest honor, the Order of Lenin. By the time the article exploded, Igor Kurchatov had already decided to begin work on a reactor dedicated to generating electricity. Development started in 1950 in a newly constructed closed city, Obninsk, 2 hours south of Moscow. There, the same group of physicists who had built the Anushka reactor were set to work on a new one, this time intended to use the heat of fission to turn water into steam and power a turbine. Resources were scarce, and some in the nuclear program believed that a power reactor could never be practical. Only as a concession to Kurchatov's prestige as the father of the bomb did Beria permit the project to proceed. It was not until the end of 1952 that the government signaled its commitment to nuclear power by naming a new design institute dedicated to creating new reactors, the Scientific Research and Design Institute of Energy Technology, known by its Russian acronym, NICIET. The following year, the USSR tested its first thermonuclear device, a hydrogen bomb, 1,000 times more destructive than the atom bomb, and both emerging superpowers became theoretically capable of wiping out humanity entirely. Even Kurchatov was shaken by the power of the new weapon he had created, which had turned the surface of the Earth to glass for 5 kilometers around ground zero. Less than 4 months later, U.S. President Dwight D. Eisenhower delivered his Atoms for Peace address to the UN General Assembly, part of an attempt to mollify an American public facing a future now menaced by the specter of apocalypse. Eisenhower called for global cooperation to control the incipient arms race and tame the power of the atom for the benefit of mankind. He proposed an international conference to consider the issue. No one was especially surprised when the USSR publicly dismissed the idea as empty propaganda. But when the UN International Conference on the Peaceful Uses of Atomic Energy finally convened in Geneva, Switzerland in August 1955, the Soviet delegation arrived in force. It marked the first time in 20 years that scientists from the USSR had been permitted to mix with their foreign counterparts, and they delivered a propaganda coup of their own. They announced that on June 27, the previous year, they had successfully connected their Obninsk reactor, designated AM-1, to the Moscow grid. It was the first reactor in the world to use nuclear power for civilian electricity generation, and the scientists christened it Atom Mirny 1, Peaceful Atom 1. At that moment, the first U.S. nuclear power station in Shippingport, Pennsylvania, was still more than 2 years from completion. Housed in a quaint stucco building with a tall chimney that could easily be mistaken for a chocolate factory, AM-1 generated only 5 megawatts, just enough to drive a locomotive, yet symbolized socialism's superior ability to harness nuclear power for the benefit of mankind. Its launch marked the birth of the Soviet nuclear energy industry and the start of a Cold War technological contest between the superpowers. Soon after the death of Stalin in 1953, Lavrenty Beria was arrested, imprisoned, and shot. The first main directorate was reconstituted and renamed. The new Ministry of Medium Machine Building, Ministerstvo Sregneva Mashinistroenia, abbreviated in Russian to Minshredmash, or simply Shredmash, would now supervise everything connected with atomic energy, from uranium mining to bomb testing. Newly appointed Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev brought an end to the years of Stalinist repression, liberalized the arts, embraced high technology, and promised that true communism, the workers' Shangri-La of equality and plenty for all, would be achieved by 1980. To help modernize the Soviet economy and also reinforce his hold on power, Khrushchev personally promoted both space travel and nuclear technology. With the success of Atom Mirny 1, the physicists and their party bosses glimpsed a panacea that would finally release the Soviet Union from the deprivation of the past and help it on the path to a brighter future. To the Soviet people, still rebuilding amid the devastation of World War II, the Obninsk reactor showed how the USSR could technologically lead the world in a way that benefited ordinary citizens, bringing heat and light into their homes. The physicists who worked on AM-1 received the Lenin Prize, and the power of the atom was hymned in magazine articles, films, and radio programs. The Ministry of Culture introduced elementary school courses teaching children the fundamentals of atomic energy and contrasting the peaceful aims of the Soviet nuclear program with the militaristic intentions of the United States. Alongside the cosmonauts and martyrs of the Great Patriotic War, according to historian Paul Josephson, the nuclear scientists became near-mythic figures in the pantheon of Soviet heroes. But the little reactor in Obninsk was not all that it seemed. The principles of its design had not originated with the imperatives of electricity generation, but with the need to manufacture plutonium bomb fuel quickly and cheaply. The same team from the Ministry of Medium Machine Building who had built the Anyushka reactor oversaw its construction. Its path to completion had been fraught with corrosion, leaks, and instrument failure. And it had first been developed to provide propulsion for nuclear submarines. Only when that proved impractical had the original codename behind its acronym AM, Adam Morsky, or Naval Adam, been revised to suggest more innocent goals. It was also inherently unstable. Unlike a nuclear weapon, in which a vast number of uranium atoms fission in a fraction of a second, releasing all their energy in an annihilating flash of heat and light, in a reactor the process must be regulated and delicately sustained for weeks, months, or even years. This requires three components, a moderator, control rods, and a coolant. The simplest form of nuclear reactor requires no equipment at all. If the right quantity of uranium-235 is gathered in the presence of a neutron moderator, water, for example, or graphite, which slows down the movement of the uranium neutrons so that they can strike one another, a self-sustaining chain reaction will begin, releasing molecular energy as heat. The ideal combination of circumstances required for such an event, a criticality, has even aligned spontaneously in nature, in ancient subterranean deposits of uranium found in the African nation of Gabon, where groundwater acted as a moderator. There, self-sustaining chain reactions began underground 2 billion years ago, producing modest quantities of heat energy, an average of around 100 kilowatts, or enough to light 1,000 light bulbs, and continued intermittently for as long as 1 million years, until the available water was finally boiled away by the heat of fission. But to generate power steadily inside a nuclear reactor, the behavior of the neutrons must be artificially controlled to ensure that the chain reaction stays constant and the heat of fission can be harnessed to create electricity. Ideally, every single fission reaction should trigger just one more fission in a neighboring atom, so that each successive generation of neutrons contains exactly the same number as the one before, and the reactor remains in the same critical state. Should each fission fail to create as many neutrons as the one before, the reactor becomes subcritical, the chain reaction slows and eventually ceases, and the reactor shuts down. But if each generation produces more than one fission, the chain reaction could begin to grow too quickly toward a potentially uncontrollable supercriticality and a sudden and massive release of energy similar to that of a nuclear weapon. To maintain a steady state between these two extremes is a delicate task. The first nuclear engineers had to develop tools to master forces perilously close to the limits of man's ability to control. Infinitesimal and invisible, the scale of subatomic activity inside a nuclear reactor is hard to comprehend. Generating a single watt of electricity requires more than 30 billion fissions every second. Around 99% of the neutrons generated in a single fission event are high-energy particles released at enormous speed. Prompt neutrons that travel at 20,000 kilometers a second. Prompt neutrons smash into their neighbors where they cause more fission, continuing the chain reaction, within an average of just 10 nanoseconds. This fraction of time, so small that the wits of the Manhattan Project measured it in shakes, for a shake of a lamb's tail, is much too fast to be controlled by any mechanical means. Fortunately, among the remaining 1% of neutrons generated in every fission event, are a tiny minority released on a timescale more readily perceptible by man, measured in seconds or even minutes. It is only the existence of these delayed neutrons, which emerge slowly enough to respond to human control, that make the operation of a nuclear reactor possible at all. By inserting electromechanical rods containing neutron-absorbing elements such as boron or cadmium, which act like atomic sponges, soaking up and trapping delayed neutrons, preventing them from triggering further fission, the growth of the chain reaction can be controlled incrementally. With the rods inserted all the way into the reactor, the core remains in a subcritical state. As they are withdrawn, fission increases slowly until the reactor becomes critical, and can then be maintained in that state and adjusted as necessary. Withdrawing the control rods farther or in greater numbers increases reactivity and thus the amount of heat and power generated, while inserting them farther has the opposite effect. But controlling the reactor using only this fraction of less than 1% of all neutrons in every fission makes the control process acutely sensitive. If the rods are withdrawn too quickly, too far, in too large a number, or any of the myriad safety systems fail, the reactor may be overwhelmed by the fission of prompt neutrons and become prompt supercritical. The result is a reactor runaway, a catastrophic scenario accidentally triggering a similar process to the one designed into the heart of an atomic bomb, creating an uncontrollable surge of power that increases until the reactor core either melts down or explodes. To generate electricity, the uranium fuel inside a reactor must become hot enough to turn water into steam, but not so hot that the fuel itself starts to melt. To prevent this, in addition to control rods and a neutron moderator, the reactor requires a coolant to remove excess heat. The first reactors built in the United Kingdom used graphite as a moderator and air as a coolant. Later commercial models in the United States employed boiling water as both a coolant and a moderator. Both designs had distinct hazards and benefits. Water does not burn, although when turned to pressurized steam it can cause an explosion. Graphite couldn't explode, but at extreme temperatures it could catch fire. The first Soviet reactors, copied from those built for the Manhattan Project, used both graphite and water. It was a risky combination. In graphite, a moderator that burns fiercely at high temperatures, and in water, a potentially explosive coolant. Three competing teams of physicists produced the initial proposals for what became Atom Mirny 1. These included a graphite water design, another that used a graphite moderator and helium as a coolant, and a third using beryllium as a moderator. But the Soviet engineers' work on the plutonium production plants meant that they had far more practical experience with graphite water reactors. These were also cheaper and easier to construct. The more experimental and potentially safer concepts never had a chance. It wasn't until late in the construction of Atom Mirny 1 that the physicists in Obninsk discovered the first major defect with their design, a risk of coolant water leaking onto the hot graphite, which could lead not only to an explosion and radioactive release, but also to a reactor runaway. The team repeatedly delayed the launch of the reactor as they devised safety systems to address the problem, but when it finally went critical in June 1954, Atom Mirny 1 retained another profound drawback the scientists never fixed, a phenomenon known as the positive void coefficient. When working normally, all nuclear reactors cooled by water contain some steam also circulating through the core, which forms bubbles or voids in the liquid. Water is a more efficient neutron moderator than steam, so the volume of steam bubbles in the water affects the reactivity of the core. In reactors that use water as both coolant and moderator, as the volume of steam increases, fewer neutrons are slowed, so reactivity falls. If too much steam forms, or even if the coolant leaks out entirely, the chain reaction stops and the reactor shuts itself down. This negative void coefficient acts like a dead man's handle on the reactor, a safety feature of the water-water designs common in the West. But in a water-graphite reactor like Atom Mirny 1, the effect is the opposite. As the reactor becomes hotter and more of the water turns to steam, the graphite moderator keeps doing its job just as before. The chain reaction continues to grow, the water heats further, and more of it turns to steam. That steam, in turn, absorbs fewer and fewer neutrons, and the chain reaction accelerates still further in a feedback loop of growing power and heat. To stop or slow the effect, the operators must rely on inserting the reactor control rods. If they were to fail for any reason, the reactor could run away, melt down, or explode. This positive void coefficient remained a fatal defect at the heart of Atom Mirny 1 and overshadowed the operation of every Soviet water graphite reactor that followed. On February 20, 1956, Igor Kurchatov materialized before the Soviet public for the first time in more than 10 years. The father of the bomb had been enveloped in the secrecy surrounding problem number one since 1943. Isolated in the clandestine laboratories of Moscow and Obninsk, were lost in the vastness of the weapons testing grounds of Kazakhstan. But now he stood before the delegates assembled for the 20th Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union in Moscow, where he revealed a fantastical vision of a new USSR powered by nuclear energy. In a short but galvanizing speech, Kurchatov outlined plans for an ambitious program of experimental reactor technology and a futuristic communist empire crisscrossed by atomic-propelled ships, trains, and aircraft. He predicted that cheap electricity would soon reach every corner of the Union through a network of giant nuclear power stations. He promised that Soviet nuclear capacity would reach 2 million kilowatts, 400 times what the Obninsk plant could produce, within just 4 years. To realize this audacious vision, Kurchatov, now named head of his own Institute of Atomic Energy, had convinced the chief of Shredmash to let him build 4 different reactor prototypes, from which he hoped to choose the designs that would prove the basis of the Soviet nuclear industry. But before construction could begin, Kurchatov also had to win over the economics mandarins of Gosplan, who controlled the distribution of all resources throughout the USSR. Gosplan's own Department of Energy and Electrification set targets for everything from how much money could be allocated for building an individual power station to the quantity of electricity it would be expected to produce once complete. And the men and women of Gosplan cared little for ideology, Soviet prestige, or the triumph of socialist over capitalist technology. They wanted rational economics and tangible results. Like their counterparts in the West, the Soviet scientists' arguments about how quickly and inexpensively nuclear power could become competitive with conventionally produced electricity were speculative and colored by wishful thinking about electricity too cheap to meter. But unlike the boosters of the nuclear future in the United States, the Soviets could not rely on golf course sales pitches and entrepreneurial investment from the free market. And economics were not on their side. The capital costs of building any nuclear reactor were colossal, and the USSR was rich in fossil fuels, especially beneath the remote wastes of Siberia, where new oil and gas deposits were being discovered all the time. Yet the sheer size of the Union and its poor infrastructure favored nuclear power. The scientists pointed out that the Siberian deposits were thousands of miles from where they were most needed, in the western part of the Soviet Union, where the majority of its population and industry lay. Moving either raw materials or electricity over these distances was costly and inefficient. Meanwhile, the nuclear plant's closest competition, hydroelectric stations, required flooding huge areas of valuable farmland. Nuclear stations, while expensive to build, had little environmental impact. They were largely independent of natural resources. They could be located close to the sources of demand in major cities, and if constructed on a large enough scale, they could produce vast amounts of electricity. Apparently convinced by Kurchatov's promises, Gosplan released the money for 2 prototype plants, one with a pressurized water reactor of the kind already becoming standard in the United States, and another with a water graphite channel type, a scaled-up version of Atom Mirny 1. But, just as they would in the West, construction costs quickly skyrocketed, and Gosplan suspected the scientists had misled them. They scaled back the plans and called a halt to work on the PWR plant, and Kurchatov's vision of the atom-powered future gradually collapsed. He pleaded for the flow of resources to be turned back on, writing to the head of Gosplan to insist that the plants were crucial for determining the future of the Soviet atom. But his pleas went unheeded, and in 1960, Kurchatov died without seeing his dream revived. In the meantime, the Ministry of Medium Machine Building had completed a new project, hidden inside the clandestine nuclear site known as Combine 816, or Tomsk 7, in western Siberia. The EI-2, or Ivan II, was a big military water graphite reactor with a thrifty edge. Its predecessor, Ivan I, had been a simple model built solely to manufacture plutonium for nuclear warheads. But EI-2 had been adapted to perform 2 tasks at once. It made weapons-grade plutonium and, as a byproduct of the process, also generated 100 megawatts of electricity. And when work on the Soviet civil nuclear program finally restarted 2 years after Kurchatov's death, by then lagging behind its competition in the United States, it did so with a new emphasis on reactors that were affordable to build and cheap to run. At that moment, it was not the sophisticated experimental reactors of Igor Kurchatov's civilian nuclear program, but the stalwart Ivan II that stood ready to carry the atomic banner for the Soviet Union. Less than a year after Igor Kurchatov presented his imperial vision of an atom-powered USSR to the Party Congress in Moscow, a toothy young Queen Elizabeth II made her own ceremonial appearance outside Calder Hall Nuclear Power Station on the northwest coast of England. Pulling a lever with elegantly gloved hands, she watched as the needle on an oversized meter began to spin, showing the first atomic electricity flowing into the British national grid from one of the station's two gas-cooled reactors. It was pronounced the launch of the first commercial-scale nuclear power station in the world, the dawn of a new industrial revolution, and a triumph for those who had kept the faith in the peaceful power of the atom when others had feared it would bring only destruction to the world. For them, a newsreel commentator reported, this day is a milestone of victory. The event was a grand propaganda exercise. The truth was darker. Calder Hall had been constructed to manufacture plutonium for Britain's own nascent atom bomb program. What electricity it did produce was a costly fig leaf. And the military roots of the civilian nuclear industry had entangled not only the technology it relied upon, but also the minds of its custodians. Even in the West, nuclear scientists continued to dwell in a culture of secrecy and expedience, an environment in which sometimes reckless experimentation was married with an institutional reluctance to acknowledge when things went wrong. A year after Calder Hall opened, in October 1957, technicians at the neighboring Windscale breeder reactor faced an almost impossible deadline to produce the tritium needed to detonate a British hydrogen bomb. Hopelessly understaffed and working with an incompletely understood technology, they operated in emergency conditions and cut corners on safety. On October 9, the 2,000 tons of graphite in Windscale Pile No. 1 caught fire. It burned for 2 days, releasing radiation across the United Kingdom and Europe and contaminating local dairy farms with high levels of iodine-131. As a last resort, the plant manager ordered water poured onto the pile, not knowing whether it would douse the blaze or cause an explosion that would render large parts of Great Britain uninhabitable. A board of inquiry completed a full report soon after, but on the eve of publication, the British Prime Minister ordered all but 2 or 3 existing copies recalled and had the metal type prepared to print it broken up. He then released his own Baudelaireized version to the public, edited to place blame for the fire on the plant operators. The British government would not fully acknowledge the scale of the accident for another 30 years. Meanwhile, in the USSR, endemic nuclear secrecy had reached fresh extremes. Under Khrushchev, Soviet scientists began to enjoy unprecedented autonomy, and the public, encouraged to trust unquestioningly in the new gods of science and technology, were kept in the dark. In this intoxicating atmosphere, the physicists' early success in taming the power of the peaceful atom made them dangerously overconfident. They began using gamma rays to extend the shelf life of chicken and strawberries. They built mobile nuclear reactors mounted on tank treads or designed to float around the Arctic. And, like their U.S. counterparts, they designed atomic-powered aircraft. But they also used nuclear weapons to put out fires and excavate underground caverns, restricting the size of their explosions only when the seismic shock began to destroy nearby buildings. Following the death of Igor Kurchatov, the Institute of Atomic Energy had been renamed in his honor, and leadership of Soviet nuclear science had passed to his disciple, Anatoly Alexandrov, an imposing man with a glisteningly bald head who'd helped build the first plutonium production reactors. Alexandrov was appointed director of the Kurchatov Institute in 1960. A dedicated communist who believed entirely in science as an instrument of the Soviet economic dream, he prized monumental projects over cutting-edge research. As the era of stagnation began, the Soviet scientific establishment lavished resources on the immediate priorities of the state, space exploration, water diversion, nuclear power, while emergent technologies, including computer science, genetics, and fiber optics, fell behind. Alexandrov oversaw the design of reactors for nuclear submarines and icebreakers, as well as the prototypes of the new channel-type graphite reactors designed to generate electricity. To reduce the cost of building these, he emphasized economies of scale and insisted on increasing their size to colossal proportions using standardized components and common factory materials. He saw no reason that manufacturing nuclear reactors should be any different from making tanks or combine harvesters. Alexandrov regarded the serial production of these massive reactors as the key to Soviet economic development, and atomic power as the means to realize Ozymandian dreams of irrigating deserts, bringing tropical oases to the Arctic North, and leveling inconveniently situated mountains with atom bombs. Or, as the Russian expression went, correcting the mistakes of nature. Despite his breadth of vision and political influence, Aleksandrov did not have sovereignty over Soviet nuclear science. Behind him loomed the sinister, adamantine power of the Ministry of Medium Machine Building and its belligerent chief, the veteran revolutionary Efim Slavsky, variously known as Big Efim and the Ayatollah. Although as young men they had fought on opposite sides in the Russian Civil War, Slavsky on horseback as a political commissar with the Red Cavalry, Aleksandrov with the White Guard, the two atomic magnates were close and enjoyed reminiscing together over vodka and cognac. But as the Cold War intensified, the military-industrial demands of Sredmash overwhelmed those of the pure scientists at the Kurchatov Institute. In the first few years of its existence, the national priority afforded the atom weapons program had allowed the ministry to consolidate control of a massive nuclear empire, with its own scientists, troops, experimental labs, factories, hospitals, colleges, and testing grounds. Sredmash could call upon almost unlimited resources, from gold mines to power stations, all maintained behind an impenetrable wall of silence. The very names of Sredmash facilities were classified, and sites that ranged in size from individual institutes in Moscow and Leningrad to entire cities were known by the men and women who worked there as Pochtovoy Yeshiki, post office boxes, referred to only by code numbers. Led by Slavsky, a cunning political operator with access to the highest levels of government, the Ministry of Medium Machine Building became closed and almost entirely autonomous, a state within a state. Under the paranoid regime of permanent warfare maintained by Sredmash, any accident, no matter how minor, was regarded as a state secret policed by the KGB. And even as the USSR's nuclear power industry began to gather momentum in the mid-1960s, the clandestine impulse persisted. In the bureaucratic upheaval that followed the fall of Khrushchev, in 1966, responsibility for operating new atomic stations throughout the USSR was transferred from Sredmash to the civilian Ministry of Energy and Electrification. Yet everything else, the design and technical supervision of the reactors that powered the plants, their prototypes, and every aspect of their fuel cycle, remained in the hands of the Ministry of Medium Machine Building. As one of the 12 founding members of the International Atomic Energy Agency, since 1957, the USSR had been obliged to report any nuclear accident that took place within its borders. But of the dozens of dangerous incidents that occurred inside Soviet nuclear facilities over the decades that followed, not one was ever mentioned to the IAEA. For almost 30 years, both the Soviet public and the world at large were encouraged to believe that the USSR operated the safest nuclear industry in the world. The cost of maintaining this illusion had been high. At 4:20 p.m. on Sunday, September 29, 1957, a massive explosion occurred inside the perimeter of Chelyabinsk 40 in the southern Urals, a Sredmash installation so clandestine that it had never appeared on any civilian map. The forbidden area encompassed both the Mayak Production Association, a cluster of plutonium production reactors and radiochemical factories scraped from the wilderness by forced labor, and Ozersk, the comfortable closed city that housed the privileged technicians who staffed them. It was a warm, sunny afternoon. When they heard the explosion, many of Ozersk's citizens were watching a soccer match in the city stadium. Assuming it was the sound of foundations being dynamited by convicts in the nearby industrial zone, few of the spectators even looked up. The match continued. But the explosion had taken place inside an underground waste storage tank filled with highly radioactive plutonium processing waste. The blast, which occurred spontaneously after cooling and temperature monitoring systems had failed, threw the tank's 160-ton concrete lid 20 meters into the air, blew out the windows of a nearby prisoner barracks, ripped metal gates from the nearby fence, and launched a kilometer-tall pillar of dust and smoke into the sky. Within a few hours, a blanket of gray radioactive ash and debris several centimeters thick had settled over the industrial zone. The soldiers who worked there were soon admitted to the hospital, bleeding and vomiting. No emergency plans had been prepared for a nuclear accident. At first, no one realized they were facing one. It was hours before the plant managers, away on business, were finally tracked down at a circus show in Moscow. By then, highly radioactive contamination had begun to spread across the Urals, 2 million curies of it, falling in a deadly trace 6 kilometers wide and nearly 50 kilometers long. The next day, light rain and a thick, black snow fell on nearby villages. It took a year to clean up inside the Forbidden Zone. The so-called liquidation of the consequences of the explosion was begun by soldiers who ran into the contaminated areas with shovels and tossed parts of the shattered waste storage container into a nearby swamp. The city leaders of Ozersk, apparently fearing mass panic more than the threat of radiation, attempted to stifle news of what had happened. But as rumors spread throughout the cadres of young engineers and technicians, nearly 3,000 workers left the city, preferring to take their chances in what they called the big world beyond the perimeter wire, rather than remain in their cozy but contaminated homes. In the remote villages outside the wire, barefoot women and children were instructed to harvest their potatoes and beets, but then dump them into trenches dug by bulldozers overseen by men wearing protective suits and respirators. Soldiers herded the peasants' cows into open pits and shot them. Eventually, 10,000 people were ordered permanently evacuated over the course of 2 years. Entire settlements were plowed into the ground. 23 villages were wiped from the map, and up to 500,000 people were exposed to dangerous levels of radioactivity. Rumors of what had happened in Mayak reached the west, but Chelyabinsk 40 was among the most fiercely guarded military locations in the USSR. The Soviet government refused to acknowledge its very existence, let alone that anything might have happened there. The CIA resorted to sending high-altitude U-2 spy planes to photograph the area. It was on the second of these missions, in May 1960, that Francis Gary Powers's aircraft was shot down by a Soviet SA-2 surface-to-air missile in what became one of the defining events of the Cold War. Although it would be decades before the truth finally emerged, the Mayak disaster remained, for many years, the worst nuclear accident in history. 3. Friday, April 25, 5 p.m., Pripyat. The afternoon of Friday, April 25, 1986, was beautiful and warm in Pripyat, more like summer than late spring. Almost everyone was looking forward to the long weekend leading into May Day. Technicians were preparing the grand opening of the city's new amusement park, and families were filling their fridges with food for the holiday. Some were engaged in the home improvement fad sweeping the city, hanging wallpaper and laying tiles in their apartments. Outside, the scent of apple and cherry blossom lingered in the air. Fresh laundry hung on the balconies of Lenina Prospect. Beneath their windows, Viktor Bruhanov's roses were in bloom, a palette of pink, red, and fuchsia. In the distance, the V.I. Lenin Atomic Energy Station, attended by the huge latticed power masts carrying high-tension cables to the switching stations, shone a brilliant white against the skyline. On the roof of the 10-story apartment building on Sergeant Lazarev Street, overlooking the central square, giant, angular white letters spelled out in Ukrainian the mellifluous propaganda jingle of the Ministry of Energy and Electrification, «Ай бута атом роботникам, а не солдатам». Let the atom be a worker, not a soldier. Bruhanov, harried by work as usual, had left for the office at 8 a.m. and driven the short distance from the family apartment overlooking Kurchatov Street to the plant in the white Volga he used for official business. Valentina had arranged to take the afternoon off from her job in the plant construction offices to spend time with her daughter and her son-in-law, who had both driven over from Kiev to visit for the weekend. Lilia was already 5 months pregnant, and the weather was so good that the three of them decided to take a day trip to Naravlia, a riverside town a few kilometers over the border in Belarus. Alexander Yuvchenko, senior mechanical engineer in the reactor department on the night shift of Chernobyl's Unit 4, spent the day in Pripyat with his 2-year-old son, Kirill. Yuvchenko had worked at the station for only 3 years. Lean and athletic, almost 2 meters tall, he'd built up his towering frame with competitive rowing in high school back in Tiraspol, in the tiny Soviet Republic of Moldova. At 13, Yuvchenko had been one of the first members of the city rowing club, where the trainer selected only the tallest and strongest boys to test themselves on the fast-flowing waters of the Dniester. At 16, he became the junior league champion in Moldova. His team went on to take second place in the All-Union Youth Competition, competing against teams from across the entire USSR. But Yevchenko was also gifted in physics and mathematics, and at 17 he showed such promise as a rower that he faced a painful decision: go to university or pursue a career in athletics. It was only over the objections of his trainer that he finally chose academia. In 1978, he enrolled to major in nuclear physics at Odessa National Polytechnic University, less than 100 kilometers away from home, just across the border in Ukraine. He was young and zealous, and had decided to do something futuristic and spectacular. He dreamed of working at a nuclear power station. Now, at 24, Yevchenko was deputy secretary of the Chernobyl plant's Komsomol, the Young Communist League, the party's youth wing. In spite of the long hours he put in at work, he still liked to play ice hockey with his friends from the station on the rinks poured in the city every winter. In the spring, he and his wife Natalia borrowed a neighbor's small motorboat, and together the family took trips down the Pripyat River, idling through the slick, brown water, drifting past forest glades carpeted with sweet-scented lilies of the valley, stopping at empty beaches of fine, white sand surrounded by towering pines. Alexander and Natalia had first met as children in Tiraspol, where they were in the same class at school. At 12, Alexander was already taller than the other boys, gangly and clumsy. Natalia was slight and spoiled. Her parents were members of the Nomenklatura, loyal party members, both with senior management positions in local industry. She wore her dark hair in two braids that dangled to the small of her back. Her blue-gray eyes seemed to change color with her mood and the weather. Alexander noticed her immediately, but if she reciprocated his interest, she didn't show it. A few years later, Alexander and his family moved into an apartment on Sovietska Street, directly opposite the small private house where Natalia lived. They began dating on and off, often breaking up, seeing other people, but always got back together again. Finally, in August 1982, after spending an entire year apart, they married. By then, they were both deep into their studies at the University of Odessa. Natalia was 21, Alexander just 20. Kirill was born a year later. Like all newly qualified Soviet specialists, when Alexander graduated in 1983, he had to choose a posting from a government shortlist of work assignments. But there was never really any question about which he would take. The Chernobyl nuclear power plant was one of the best and most prestigious nuclear facilities in the entire Soviet Union. It was in Ukraine, close to Kiev, and surrounded by tranquil countryside. Most important, he'd heard that married couples moving to Pripyat could expect to be allocated an apartment in the city. Alexander hoped that he and his new family would have a place of their own within a year, an unthinkable prospect elsewhere in the Soviet Union. When their son was born, Natalia still had another year of her degree in Russian philology to complete. She stayed in Odessa while Alexander moved into a single men's dormitory in Pripyat and began working at the plant. And when she first visited him there at the end of December 1983, she saw none of the city's vaunted beauty. In the flat winter light, Pripyat was wan and featureless, stifled between the fallow landscape and grubby dishwater skies. She was struck only by the concrete monument that marked the entrance to the city in massive, brutalist characters, reading, "Pripyat, 1970. But the next year, the family was assigned an apartment on the top floor of a big building in a newly completed district of town on Stroitaly Prospect, Avenue of the Construction Workers. They moved into it in August, and the two-room flat seemed as big as a palace. From the balcony, the Yevchenkos had a sweeping view of the Pripyat River and the forest beyond. A fresh breeze blew through the kitchen windows. They hung bright pink floral wallpaper in the living room and filled it with furniture Natalia's mother had secured through connections at the timber combinat where she worked. There was little call for the expertise of a philology graduate in the technically focused world of the Atomgrad, so Natalia went to work as a schoolteacher. School number 4 was enormous, with more than 2,000 children. Natalia taught Russian language and literature and supervised a fourth-grade class. She often wondered why she had to spend her time looking after other people's children while her own son languished in a creche. By spring 1986, Alexander had been promoted from circulation pump operator to senior mechanical engineer in the number 4 reactor department. At the end of March, he was summoned to the offices of the Pripyat Communist Party. They offered him the job of first secretary of the city Komsomol. Unlike his part-time role in the plant organization, This was a full-time political position and would mean resigning from the job he loved at Unit 4. Yevchenko declined. They insisted. He declined again, this time quoting a few lines from Engels. They allowed him to go home, but Alexander knew he couldn't say no forever. Nobody could refuse the party's requests. In the meantime, with two salaries and a place of their own, the Yevchenkos had all they needed. They began thinking about a second child. Still, with no family nearby to provide help, life was hardly easy. In the second half of April that year, Kirill became sick with a bad cold. At first, Natalia took time off work to look after him, but the illness lingered, and when she had to go back to her students, the couple began sharing childcare. When Alexander was on the night shift at the plant, caring for the boy during the day fell to him. When Natalia returned home from work on the afternoon of April 25, she looked down from the apartment window and spotted her husband on the street below, giving Kirill a ride on the crossbar of his bike. Alexander had worked from midnight until 8 the previous night, and then spent all day with their son without sleeping. He was due back at the plant again in just a few hours for another shift. Natalia realized how exhausted he must be, and the thought made her uneasy. Despite the bright sunshine and the excited cries of her son drifting up from below, a shadow of apprehension passed over her. After dinner, Natalia put Kirill to bed and sat down to watch the climactic episode of a TV miniseries, the Soviet blockbuster adaptation of Irwin Shaw's potboiler, Rich Man, Poor Man. Alexander usually left for the night shift at around 10:30 p.m., but he seemed restless and prepared for work with an odd meticulousness. He spent almost an hour taking a bath, then he put on a smart new outfit, a pair of slacks, and a coveted Finnish-made windbreaker, as if he were going to a party, not a power station. He poured a cup of coffee, alone in the kitchen, but he wanted company and asked Natalia to join him. She left the TV, and they spent the next few minutes talking about nothing much until finally it was time for him to go. A few hundred meters away from the Yevchenkos, in his apartment opposite the big swimming pool on Sportivnaya Street, Sasha Kirill was reading on the couch when his friend Leonid Toptanov ambled in. The two nuclear engineers had been close for almost a decade, ever since the early days of their studies at a branch of Moscow Engineering and Physics Institute, MIFI, in the nuclear city of Obninsk. Now they lived one floor apart in a block of almost identical one-room apartments, occupied by doctors, teachers, and other single young nuclear engineers. The two men shared keys and let themselves into each other's homes whenever they felt like it. Kirill, the son of a physics teacher, and Toptanov, the only child of a senior army officer attached to the Russian space program, both had science in their blood. They had been born into a world where, in the late 1950s and early 1960s, the startling coups of Soviet engineers regularly humbled the West. Toptanov's father had been at the heart of the USSR's shadow world of clandestine technology, overseeing the construction of rocketry facilities at Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan, the site in 1957 of the surprise launch of Sputnik, which first shattered the United States' complacent assumptions about its technical superiority over an empire of ham-fisted potato farmers. Toptanov was born within sight of the Baikonur launch pad, in the secret space city of Leninsk, 3 years later. He grew up surrounded by the hallowed group of men and women who would lead mankind into orbit, idolized not just by the children who lived around the cosmodrome, but throughout the USSR. Toptanov's father liked to boast that Yuri Gagarin, soon to be the most famous man on Earth, used to babysit the infant Leonid. When Gagarin's massive Vostok 1 rocket thundered off the launch pad early one morning in April 1961, Toptanov, just 7 months old, was there to witness its blazing exhaust plume vanish into the stratosphere, and a Soviet pilot became the first human being in space. When Toptanov was 13, his father was appointed military attaché at the Dvitichel rocket engine plant in Tallinn, and the family moved to Estonia. 3 years later, in July, Toptanov went to Moscow to sit for the MIFI entrance exams. Reserved and attentive, he had proved an able student in math. But MIFI, established with the patronage of Kurchatov, the father of the Soviet atom bomb, was the USSR's most prestigious institute for the study of nuclear engineering and physics. The examination was notoriously difficult, with as many as 4 students competing for every place. Some sat for it again and again before being admitted. While Toptanov toiled over the test papers, his father waited outside the room on a bench. When the young man emerged at last, he was shaking with exhaustion. Toptanov passed on the first attempt, but when he called to give his mother the good news, she pleaded with him not to go. He was her only child, and the idea of nuclear power terrified her. She begged him to remain in Tallinn and study there. But Leonid had no interest in life in a Baltic backwater. At 17, he left home to join the cult of the Atomshiki, the disciples of the peaceful atom. Toptanov met Sasha Karol in 1977 as part of a group of 30 or so first-year students studying atomic power plant engineering at the MIFI campus in Obninsk. It was a place of thrilling novelties for the aspirant teenaged engineers, a complex surrounded by 16 other research facilities and with access to two small research reactors. The coursework was tough, beginning with general disciplines, mathematics, technical drawing, and chemistry, but also political indoctrination. To excel, the students had to pass courses in historical materialism and scientific communism, the study of the history of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union, and the social laws established by Marx and developed by Lenin and Brezhnev, leading to the state of true communism, then scheduled to arrive in the year 2000. In their spare time, the young freshmen in Obninsk were like students everywhere. They drank beer and played cards and went to films and shows. Especially popular were the improvised comedy competitions based on the format of the TV show KVN, Klub Veselyukh i Nahochevikh, or the Club of the Merry and Quick-Witted, which, although by then long banished from television by Soviet censors, lived on as a cult live spectacle at colleges across the Union. Toptanov, shy-looking, with glasses and a lingering hint of puppy fat, was frustrated by his boyish appearance. He grew a mustache that he hoped gave him an air of sophistication. With a charming smile and a thick shock of shaggy brown hair, he did well with girls. At MIFI, Toptanov took up karate, a sport on the long and often inexplicable list of ideas and practices from outside the USSR that were officially forbidden. But information about it was available in samizdat form, and Toptanov learned to kick and punch from illegally circulated homemade manuals. Against the advice of his tutors, who warned their students it could damage their eyesight and with it their future in the nuclear industry, he also began to box. Although his retinas emerged from the ring intact, he did eventually have his nose broken, leaving him with a chronic nasal dribble. One night after class, Toptanov got into a drunken argument with an overbearing thermodynamics tutor. The dispute escalated, and in the bathroom, the two men came to blows. Toptanov gave the tutor a black eye. Afterward, the young student was threatened with expulsion, but somehow granted a reprieve, stayed on. After 4 years of study at MIFI, Toptanov and Karol began their diploma projects. Karol focused on a technique to isolate faulty fuel rods, while Toptanov worked on using acoustics to identify irregularities in the performance of the reactor. The diploma research required a 6-month internship at a nuclear station somewhere in the USSR, and both chose Chernobyl. They liked it so much there that, upon finally graduating from MIFI in 1983, they opted to return to Chernobyl for their full-time work assignments. Toptanov and Karol arrived just in time for the completion of Chernobyl's Unit 4, the newest and most advanced of the station's RBMK reactors. Like all other new engineers, they had to start at the bottom, doing menial work for which they were overqualified, patrolling the plant with an oil can, feeling machinery for hot bearings, mopping up spills, while they learned the practicalities and layout of the station and its equipment. The young specialists learned quickly that it was one thing to understand how the reactor worked in principle, and quite another to understand it in reality. When their working shifts ended, they stayed in the station for hours, putting in extra time to trace the pathway of giant steam pipes and cables by hand, finding the location of huge gate valves in the dark, following myriad connections from room to room and floor to floor. It was common practice, too, for the trainees to return to the plant at all hours of the day and night to observe both routine work and special tests in the hope of gathering extra knowledge that might speed their advancement. During the summer and autumn of 1983, as reactor number 4 was undergoing final assembly, the new trainees were given responsibility for managing quality control. While the giant cylindrical concrete vault, cast to contain the active zone of the reactor, was filled slowly with the thousands of tons of rectangular graphite blocks that would help moderate its fission, Toptanov, Kroll, and the other apprentice operators clambered inside it to check the progress of construction. They compared the work of the assembling teams against the designer's blueprints and looked for leaks and cracks in the graphite pile. They monitored the welding of the scores of water pipelines that would circulate cooling water through the core, a gleaming thicket of narrow-bore stainless steel. Finally, when the vault was filled and the pipework complete, they watched as the reactor was sealed, loaded with